There will be no personal nor direct attacks on anyone. And I would ask that you please try to keep down the loud cheering and the clapping. There will be no booing and no unruly behavior. With that,
this is painful, and it will be for a long time.
Donald Trump, baby! That's right, this man knows what's up!
This is Midday Mobile with Sean Sullivan on FM Talk 106.5.
Well, Sean's a tough guy. I mean, I think everybody knows that. You know, Sean, he took some licks. He hangs in there.
Yeah, what's wrong with the bill we got? I mean, the bill we got drank pretty good, don't it?
Did you hear what I said?
So this is a brave council. I had no doubt about them.
That doesn't suck.
If you don't like it, too bad.
Last question. Were you high on drugs?
Last question. Kiss my...
All right, FM Talk 106.5 and Midday Mobile, glad to have you here on this Tuesday. And I want to continue a little bit, even though we talk about the some national news and talk about the president and maybe even talk some tariffs here. My friend Brendan Kirby with LifeSet.com and Yellowhammer News, author of Wicked Mobile, he and I were talking during the news break, and you added one more leg to that stool, to the trifecta here, because I was mentioning two sectors that did not follow the normal path of inflation, and that was what we're talking about last hour. That's healthcare and tuitions, education. And you said, Sullivan, add one more.
Yeah, defense, national defense.
What do those have in common? What do those three things have in common?
Well, I'm going to go out on a limb here and say those are the three sectors that the government is most heavily involved in. Now, national defense is sort of obvious. I mean, there's not really an alternative to that. But education and healthcare as well. And this is just the basic law of economics. When somebody else is paying the bills and is pouring lots of extra money in, the price is going to go up. I mean, this is just sort of elementary, which is why, whenever people fret about the cost of healthcare or education, the politician's answer is always, well, we need to spend more taxpayer money on it. You know, it's expensive. We got to put more taxpayer money in. If you really wanted to reduce the price, you'd do the opposite. You'd take the government money out, and then the price would come down. And if you don't believe me, just ask yourself this. If everyone had to pay the sticker price on a college education, how many people would go to college? I mean, literally, a whole lot of people wouldn't be able to afford to go at the prices they charge.
And that's a tough thing. I mean, I don't want
of government money. Yeah.
Well, the tough thing is would be that transition period, right? That would be because right. I think the market would correct. I think I don't know how to deal with that in between time because I don't want to put have people suffer under what needs to be the Band-Aid being ripped off. But when you do rip the Band-Aid off, I think within 5 years' time, there would be a correction to what they are charging per semester hour at colleges and universities, and you would have a resetting of the market. If the money was not there, therefore the students weren't there to pay for it, therefore they would have to adjust to what the market would bear, like everything else.
Right, exactly. I mean, and that's just absolutely true. You know, colleges always claim poor, and they say that they're nonprofit institutions, and you know they're just making ends meet,
right.
And
uh-huh.
They couldn't possibly cut anymore. I mean, no one wants to cut money, but if you look at what colleges have done over the last 30 years, they've put a lot of money into building up extra things to try to attract students. They've built really fancy residence halls. I think you and I went to college at the same time,
mm-hmm.
and I'm guessing the dorm rooms at the University of Alabama were not any fancier than they were at American University.
Patey Hall, University of Alabama. There are going to be people on the text line know what I'm talking about.
I mean, they were basic, kind of living quarters,
Yes. Yes. Basic living quarters is probably a flowery description of where we were staying then. That is for sure. We lose Brendan? All right, when we get Brendan back on, we lost the link there. We are going to talk a bit about the president's speech in just about wrapped up about 30 minutes ago. Also, this tweet that started off our morning as the president tweeting that tariffs are the greatest. That and the push to get Doug Jones, Alabama Senator Doug Jones, to vote yes on confirmation for the president's nominee, Brett Kavanaugh, for Supreme Court. Tell you what we'll do. Run to the break, and we'll get Brendan back on, and we'll be right back. This is Midday Mobile on FM Talk 106.5.
This is Midday Mobile with Sean Sullivan on FM Talk 106.5.
at 116 FM Talk 106.5 Midday Mobile. All right, continue our conversation with Brendan Kirby with LifeSet.com, YellowhammerNews.com, also the author of Wicked Mobile. And I'd like to point out, too, the technology that lets us talk here that just failed us there for a second. But technology gets cheaper as tuition gets more expensive out there. That's all I'm saying. But you pointed out the third leg to that stool, and you had defense spending in there. And you're right. All three of them are subsidized.
Yeah, and actually, you bring up technology. I had a conversation with a libertarian healthcare expert not long ago, and he was just talking about this very phenomenon and the government's attempt to create universal health coverage is enormously expensive. And he contrasted that with cell phones. And he said, in a very short span of time, we went from almost no one having cell phones to what you would say universal coverage of cell phones. Now almost everyone has a cell phone. And it was done with remarkably little government intervention in a very short span of time. The market just took care of that. Other than a real small amount of money that the government spends to help poor people have cell phones, for the most part, this was just done in the market. It started really expensive. The early adapters got in. It reached a tipping point, and then the price came down. He was suggesting something similar for healthcare might lead to more people getting healthcare through the free market than the government attempts. And he said, what if the government decided it's a vital interest that everyone have a cell phone at the beginning of the cell phone era and passed a bunch of regulations and rules and subsidies to make that happen? Where would we be today? It's kind of an interesting thought experiment. I don't think we know for sure, but it's hard to believe the government would have been more successful than the market has been in that regard.
All right. I want to get to a couple things here. Number one, let's talk about, speaking of what it costs to do business in this country, President Trump this morning, the first thing I see from the president is tariffs are the greatest, and some more of a tweet, but a discussion back to tariffs, and tariffs are the greatest. I don't think I've ever heard it framed that way before.
Well, that's classic Trump. And I guess what you have to ask yourself is the greatest for whom? And that's the key deal. Now, if you are in a favored protected industry, tariffs, I don't know if they're the greatest, but they're pretty darn good, right?
Right, yes.
Let's raise the cost of all of your competitors and we'll protect you. So it's obviously good for the owners of those businesses and for the workers who work for them. It's less good for the consumers that buy those products, and this is something that sort of gets lost in this debate, other manufacturers that use the protected products in their products. And we see this with steel. We might create some steel jobs by having high tariffs on steel, but it hurts domestic auto manufacturers that use the steel. And that's the difficult challenge in trying to micro-target tariffs to hit foreigners when we have global supply chains and thousands of parts in some of these products that are coming from all over the place.
Yeah, the president and others have made the argument that the reason these certain industries get favored status, number one, they've been treated unfairly, I can follow along with what he's saying, but they've treated unfairly by other countries. But also he said it is a national security interest, right? That you've got to keep the production of steel and aluminum. You have to have production of energy, different things. Has to be still a robust business in this country, in case we get in a situation where we're not doing business with those folks because they may be our enemies across the battlefield.
And I think it's a fair point, because just on the numbers, if you look at the number of steel manufacturers and aluminum smelters, they have gone down precipitously in the United States in the last 20 years. I think we have something like 2 aluminum smelting plants left in the United States, and only one of them that makes military-grade aluminum. So the question, I guess, then becomes is, does it matter? And maybe it doesn't. Let's say we didn't have any domestic steel and aluminum manufacturers. Does that make us unacceptably vulnerable? Or is there just plenty of product to be had and lots of our allies make it and we'll just buy it from them and we don't need to worry about that? That's sort of a question that's hard to answer.
It's also a hard connection to keep, I guess. I don't know what's going on there today. All right, and hopefully we get Brendan back on here soon. I don't know what is happening with his connection today. All that technology, maybe we should have subsidized it. It'd be better. This comes from, I don't know if y'all saw this, at the onset this morning of the president talking about the terrorists. And this is a discussion that I got in with Jeff Poor in the past. I think it's a fun one. I don't see it like most people 100% either way. I can see arguments made on both sides. Yes, my proclivity is for free trade. My proclivity is for free markets. But you can make arguments with me that I'll nod along with you and say you make a good argument there on tariffs. I do, academically, I don't like the idea. Am I somebody that thinks the ideas of Milton Friedman were pretty swell? Yeah, I am. But they are also things that if you argue that in a vacuum or a textbook that there are good ideas, you can argue that, well, you know, that's all great, but not everybody plays by the same rules. Therefore, tariffs are needed to help level the playing field. The problem is, though, like Brendan pointed out, you have a tariff to protect the steel industry. Hurts people. Maybe more people stay employed or come back to work in the steel industry, but now you have fewer people in auto manufacturing. You know, why are those jobs better than others? And people will argue, well, those are national security jobs versus others. But that's assuming something is going to have to happen to make it important as a national security job, right? That it's going to be a job that has to be with us because one day the Chinese or somebody else are going to cut us off from whatever this is. So, and I've had callers in the past say, listen, it's okay with me that it's bad for Alabama as long as it's good for the country. Y'all are great people. That's a great attitude. That's great. You know, that's a pretty good Christian attitude. But I would argue that's easy to say until you start losing jobs in your home state. What I'm getting at is, yeah, Alabama, and Brendan's back on with us now. So, I'm just pointing out, Brendan, that, you know, it's easy to make that argument. People say, listen, if rising tide lifts all boats, we'll take the lick here, the loss of jobs in auto manufacturing in Alabama, because it'll benefit the steel industry, and then the rising tide will lift all boats. But that's easy to say until you start having layoffs at the Hyundai or the Mercedes plant or at the Toyota Mazda plant.
Yeah, sure, absolutely. Politicians are not usually willing to endure short-term pain for long-term gain. Now, that's not assessing whether Trump is right on this or not. I mean, like I said, I think there's plenty of avenues to criticize him over this. But he believes that he's right, you know, by the way. Mm-hmm. I don't think there's any doubt on that. I mean, he's been consistent over this for decades, dating way back to when he was a private citizen. So he thinks that ultimately this is going to be good for the whole country, and he's willing to risk that kind of short-term pain for a better international trading system. If you think he's wrong on the merits, then I mean that obviously kills that. But if he is right on the merits, you know, it's sort of admirable in a way that a politician would be, you know, willing to risk the short-term disruption and pain for something longer term. We always criticize our politicians for not thinking long term and thinking only to the next election. So
I understand what you're saying.
I know people are going to jump all over me, but
well,
you know,
I'm about
sort of
to.
Admirable,
yeah,
that you have a politician that you know is willing to take that risk.
Yeah, but I see both. I completely see what you're saying, that it is could take an unpopular opinion, but in the world of populism, that unpopular opinion actually is a popular opinion. You know, you can sit here and say, well, you can easily say those people, if you're President Trump, they come after you, you'll say, well, they're globalists or they're big business or they're Chamber of Commerce people that want no tariffs. I'm concerned about regular folks because the regular individual folks at the jobs that might be lost with these tariffs don't have a voice nearly as big as the representative arm of the steel union, aluminum, you know, whatever a big trade is that's being protected.
Yeah, you know, I mean, it's the conundrum with trade in general is that international trade benefits the country in the aggregate. I don't think there's any question about that. And it benefits large numbers of people in a small way. but it doesn't help everyone, and it hurts people. And the people it hurts in a very big, invisible way. So you can see when a factory closes down because the owner has shipped jobs to China,
right,
to take advantage of trade. That, you know, that's devastating to the workers and can devastate entire towns. Meanwhile, the cheaper products that come back, you know, benefits everyone who buys them, but in a small way. You know, you're not holding press conferences,
correct,
to show people, you know, that they've saved, you know, a dollar on whatever they're buying. But, you know, a dollar here, a dollar there, it adds up to real money. So I think everyone, you know, that's really looked at this has concluded that trade raises GDP and benefits the country as a whole. This is not unlike the immigration debate. You know, immigration raises the overall GDP and makes the country richer as a whole.
Yeah, but per capita right, lowers it.
But per capita lowers it, you know, or potentially lowers it depending on you know where the immigrants are coming from and what they're earning. And that's, you know, so it benefits the whole country as a whole, but the benefits accrue disproportionately to, you know, to people at the top. And that is I think that's something that free traders, and you know, I think I've always been a free trader, you know, have been a bit too quick to dismiss, and you know, and to recognize that if we are going to do this, we should maybe think harder about what to do about the people who are displaced. And our answer so far has mainly been government-sponsored job training programs that don't work very well, according to a lot of studies that have studied them. It just you know, these programs have not been very effectual. So, you know, that's you know.
He gets cut off again. All right. Let's do this. We'll get Brendan back on after the bottom of the hour news. A couple notes here. Number one, it is now official. They had the vote count. We talked about that at the beginning of the hour. Yeah, I understand the bear is at the... Yes, I understand there's a bear spotted at the McDonald's in Pensacola. I understand that. But can we do the vote count thing? Okay. It looks like Shane Stringer... confirmed. That's what when we heard the vote count, that's what I assumed, because they had counted 13 votes for Willie Gray. And if you hadn't been following, talking about House District 102 that was in a runoff this time last week, there were 25 votes separating Shane Stringer. I assume a police chief Shane Stringer over Willie Gray. And they said either party that called for a recount would have to pay for it. And so they didn't, but they did count the provisional votes. And out of the provisional votes that applied to House District 102, remember Shane Stringer has a 25-vote advantage. 13 votes went to Willie Gray. Out of those recounted, 18 to Shane Stringer. Shane Stringer gets the win there. So we have confirmed that. We'll get the rest of the numbers as they did the recount here. Dalton, if we can follow those, if they put a story up, we'll link it through on our Facebook page. But that was a big one. Had a lot of people asking. So as I understand it now, it is official. Shane Stringer wins House District 102. And yes, I know, there's a bear. Can we go to the audio? There's a bear in the tree at the...
Americans want to protect Roe v. Wade.
No, that's not it. Where is it?
And then he fell. He came down, then he went back up the tree.
Uh-huh.
And the last time, he came down the tree, and he couldn't last any longer, and he fell.
Oh, wow.
Poor little bear. At least they didn't kill him.
So you have never seen anything like this before?
No, not in this town.
All right, there we go. So there's the latest update from the bear in the tree at the McDonald's in... Pensacola. That's the latest update from the bear cam. I think we get more bear talk. I like the bear talk on this show. I just didn't, you know, it's the middle of the day and bear in town in Pensacola. Now, I don't know which McDonald's this is. I don't recognize the part of Pensacola where it is. But it looks like it's, you know, I don't know where the bear came from. It looks like it's fairly, there's some woods off to one side. But the bear was in the parking lot, I guess, and then went up the tree. There seems to be quite a few fast food places right around here. The bear may have been interested. There's a McDonald's. There's a Popeyes there. I like Popeyes as well. I mean, I can't blame the bear for doing that. But right now, I guess, Dalton, they said the bear has fallen out of the tree, so they have the bear. Has the bear been taken into... Will there be a perp walk for the bear? Will they perp walk the bear at any point? Can we find out, WKRG? I know you got the live feed going. Will there be a perp walk? Will we get a note here when they were perp walk this black bear? All right? Please let us know this McDonald's parking lot black bear. When will they be perp walked? As soon as the news breaks on that, we'll get, look at these plates, get right to it, huh? All right, check in with Westwood One News. Also, we'll get Dr. Bill's forecast, and then we'll come right back. More of Midday Mobile on this convoluted hour, which is fine, though. We're good. We can handle it.
You're listening to Midday Mobile with Sean Sullivan on FM Talk 106.5. Call Sean now at 343-0106.
136 FM Talk 106.5 and Midday Mobile on this Tuesday. And thanks for being here. And we'll go another route, another form of connecting from the FM Talk 106.5 studios to the command center for Brendan Kirby, author of Wicked Mobile, and also does his stuff for LifeZet.com and YellowhammerNews.com. Speaking of Wicked Mobile, people want to grab a copy of that. Where do they go to get your book?
You can go, obviously, your online sources, your Amazons and your online book retailers. Of course, now that you have to pay the sales tax on online purchases, maybe you should just mosey on over to a local bookstore and get it there. Page and Palette and Fairhope, Bienville Books has had it in the past. I'm not sure if they still do. Some of the chain bookstores in the area. And, of course, why don't you tell them about my favorite one, the idea that you came up, the marketing genius.
Yes, well, anywhere that you can get a bag of Andy Capp's hot fries along with Wicked Mobile, it is a nice pairing.
Yes, absolutely.
All right, I want to continue our discussion here. And the tariff thing, you were making very cogent points before the NSA cut us off. But the tariff thing, how about this? Maybe there can be some agreement that it is a little more nuanced than mainstream media wants to or even cable media wants to frame the argument, right? I mean, there's winners and losers all over this.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's winners and losers with the status quo too.
Yes.
If you do nothing, there's winners and losers. It's difficult because you can't, to put the thumb on the scale to help one group means that another group is probably going to get hurt. And, trying to sort that out is difficult. By the way, when Trump was meeting with his G7 counterparts in Canada, he says that he told them all, look, here, why don't we just, we'll all put our trade barriers to zero, and we won't have tariffs on any of our products coming in and out.
I like that.
How about that?
Yeah.
And he said, we can't do that. And, that's like the most free trade radical position of all, is no one have any tariffs and just have a completely open and free market. I think classic economists would agree that would be the maximum system.
Yes.
It's when you negotiate these trade deals, countries are going to insist on certain carve-outs, for certain favored politically powerful, usually domestic groups, and that's sort of how we get it. And, gradually over the last 50 years, we've come closer to that zero with a lot of countries, but not there. And then the other point, and this gets lost too, and this is particularly a problem with Asian countries, and not just China, but even Japan and some of those other Asian countries, they have what they call non-tariff barriers. So ostensibly, there's no tariff that we pay or whatever the rate is, but they have certain rules that make it very hard or difficult to get the products in. And we sell very few cars in Japan. And Ford, a few years ago, actually just pulled out altogether from the Japanese market because they were selling so few. That's not because they're slapping huge tariffs on. That's because they've got these Byzantine rules, and what we say is they're applied unfairly, so that it's hard to get products that are actually approved and on the shelves or in the showrooms to actually sell. And that's a big problem, too.
All right. I want to switch gears here and talk about something that has been the all-out push. We started talking about it about a couple weeks ago, right after the announcement of Brett Kavanaugh as the president's nominee for Supreme Court. And then the full-on press has happened. I see it coming in waves. The folks from Judicial Crisis Network hopped on with us last week. I see a new wave of it coming this week as the word comes down to remind Alabamians that want Brett Kavanaugh confirmed to remind their Democrat senator to confirm him, right?
Is right, that absolutely. Yeah. And accompanying this ad blitz, it's a $1.5 million buy in Alabama and three other red states that have Democratic senators. The other three states actually have Democratic senators that are up for re-election this year. And they accompany this with a poll they paid for saying that a majority of Alabamians want Judge Kavanaugh confirmed.
Yeah, is it 54% or something for Alabama? 54%,
something like that. You know, compared to like, you know, 29% or something like that, or 30% that said no with the rest undecided. Now, my rule of thumb on polls is always to take with a grain of salt any poll that's paid for by a partisan organization that has, a definite agenda. Having said that, the results don't seem out of line with where you would expect them to be. Alabama is a pretty conservative state, so it's not surprising at all to me that a majority of people in Alabama just kind of neutrally, ask the question, should the judge be confirmed or not, would probably say yes, especially when the judge seems as qualified as Judge Kavanaugh is. Ivy League pedigree, years of experience as a federal judge and all that. So, it's going to be a tough vote for Doug Jones because, even though he doesn't have to face voters until 2020, this is the kind of vote that will be brought up by his opponent if he votes to try and kill this nomination. So he's pulled in the direction of Chuck Schumer and the rest of the Democrats in the Senate that have just made this Armageddon. On the one hand, and on the other hand, his own constituents. So it'll be very interesting to see how he comes down.
All right, I want to give you this question because the same one that I asked of Quinn Hillier this morning after talking about this, does it amount to anything? In other words, I said this morning, I'll say it again, I believe that Doug Jones should vote to confirm. I'm being, a pundit here, opinion guy. I believe that he should vote to confirm Brett Kavanaugh. But you're saying it could be used against him in 2020. Here's the scenario. The scenario is, Brendan, that Doug Jones votes to confirm Kavanaugh, and it's 2020. Does that amount to a hill of beans when he's running against a Republican for that Senate seat? I mean, just be honest. Does it matter? Does it matter?
I don't think that any one single vote that he casts in 2018 is going to make or break his reelection hopes. But there's an accumulation of votes that kind of depict the narrative. And if he can point to a bunch of votes where he broke with the Democratic leadership in high-profile cases, much like Joe Manchin, has done in West Virginia, he can say, see, look, I'm an independent Democrat. I'm not going to be a rubber stamp for President Trump, but I'm not just going to automatically vote against everything he throws up there either. Look at the times where, I have, based on my judgment, have decided to break ranks with my party. That's going to be a pretty powerful narrative to him, trying to sell the idea that he's a moderate Democrat. If he doesn't have votes like that, it's going to be a much harder case for him to make. So, no, not one individual vote, but a string of them.
Let's say he has a resume of these votes where he breaks rank with the party, the idea of a moderate Democrat is something. Number one, they are if they're not on the threatened list, they're at least a concerned creature for the World Wildlife Fund. But the moderate Democrat in the mix, in a purple state, that matters and it plays. But I just think, I'm just trying to be frank in my opinion here in Alabama, that if you have Doug Jones, and now if the Republicans don't field a decent candidate or something like that, that's a different story. But let's say it's just a decent candidate that's running for the Republicans, and you have Doug Jones arguing, listen, a lot of the times I don't vote with the Democrats. If I'm the Republican running against him, I'll say, none of the times do I vote with the Democrats, there's my argument that, he's at 65%, I'm at 100%.
Yeah, well, certainly, he's not going to win over hardcore Republican voters, and that's not the aim. The aim is to win over enough independent voters that he can win. And look, I think all things being equal, if the Republicans field a good candidate and runs a good race and the political environment is at least neutral, it's an uphill fight for Doug Jones no matter how he votes.
Right.
I agree with you on that.
Okay.
But to say that it doesn't matter, Elizabeth Warren would have a harder time winning in Alabama than Doug Jones.
Correct.
I think it's
yes.
fair to say that. So,
yes,
yeah,
yes.
I mean, obviously, people say, can Doug Jones, win re-election? Well, sure he can. Sure he can.
Yeah.
I mean, it doesn't mean he will. It's going to depend on what kind of candidate the Republicans field and what the political environment is at the time he's running. It's going to be 2020. So I think that makes it harder because it'll be a big turnout election, and big turnout elections in a presidential year tend to favor Republicans in Alabama. But I mean, if we're in the middle, say we're in the middle of a 2008 style economic collapse in 2020, you know, I mean, of course, that can cut both ways. I mean, his opponent could say, you know, it's collapsed on your watch, but he could say that Trump caused this big, great recession, and you know, you need me there checking him, or it's going to get worse. So it just depends on things we don't know right now, but. You know, I agree with you at this point. If he thinks, well, all I have to do is confirm Trump's judge and I'm home free, no, obviously not. And nor does it mean that voting against Trump's judge automatically means he loses either. But you know, but I think it does matter. And you know, you want to kind of pick your spots to show this, which is why I think, by the way, if all the Republicans stick together and vote to confirm him, I mean, he's going to win anyway. It makes it more likely that you'll see a handful of Democrats vote for him. Because if you're Joe, especially if you're up for re-election this year, you're Joe Manchin in West Virginia,
mm-hmm.
you know, why vote against someone who's going to be confirmed anyway and make your life harder? At that point, why not just, you know, vote to confirm him? Your vote doesn't matter. And then you can say, see, look, you know, I'm a reasonable person. I'll vote for Trump positions when they make sense for West Virginia or fill in the blank for your state. It's going to be very hard, though, if you say if Rand Paul were to break right.
Well, that's the noise about that. Yeah, that's the other part. Can you hang on over the break?
Yeah, sure, absolutely.
All right, coming right back, more with Brendan Kirby, because he knew I wanted to get there, because why would it be important to have Democrats voting to confirm? Because there's... They're going to need some, but they maybe need more when you have people like Rand Paul. They continue to make a lot of people scratch their heads. They like him one day. They don't like him the other day. We'll talk more about that when we return right here on Midday Mobile.
This is Midday Mobile with Sean Sullivan on FM Talk 106.5.
You know, what we should have done, Dalton, is we should have sent... some Goldfinger's catering over there to the probate judges as they were counting the 58 votes or whatever they needed to do. It was like, it was interesting to watch that today, that process, which, by the way, turned out the 18 for Shane Stringer, 13 for Willie Gray. So Shane Stringer holds on to the lead and wins the House District 102. But yeah, Goldfinger's, I'm always talking about going by, either going inside and eating or getting something through the drive-thru, but they also do catering. You can get for large parties, go ahead and go online or call ahead and do the chicken tenders, also do the wings. You get the sides like the crinkle cut fries, the Saratoga chips, sweet potato fries, baked potato cheese sticks, coleslaw, potato salad, onion rings, toast, all that good stuff. And you can pick it up right there at the Goldfingers in Saraland or on Dolphin Street. Goldfingers.com. You can go to their website, check out details, see the menu. Also, they have an app, Goldfingers app. Just search for that and you can do it right there on your phone and get that food ready for you. Love it. I do love the fried. I know I talk a bunch about the grilled chicken tenders because I'm trying to cut down on the fried food, but the fried chicken fingers are fantastic as well. Plus, they got huge menu with chicken sliders, quarter pound hamburgers, BLTs, buffalo chicken sandwiches, salads, all kind of pineapple chicken wrap, all kind of great stuff. I want you to check them out today or tomorrow. Grab lunch there. Do something new. See them at Goldfingers on Dolphin Street, not too far east of 65, kind of across from Chick-fil-A right there on Dolphin Street or in Saraland. All right, continue our conversation with Brendan Kirby from LifeSet.com. YellowhammerNews.com, and also the author of Wicked Mobile. You brought up the name of a senator that may not be a confirming vote for Brett Kavanaugh, a Republican, and that would be
Rand Paul. And
Rand Paul.
If you want to push the Sean Sullivan button, just make sure it's labeled Rand.
Yes.
Yeah, no, I mean, here's the math of the Senate. When Neil Gorsuch was up for nomination last year, there were 52 Republicans. And 48 Democrats or independents of the caucus of the Democrats. So that's your sort of margin of error. The math is narrower now because of Alabama. Doug Jones replaced Luther Strange. So now there are only 51 Republicans in the Senate, and one of them is John McCain, who's very sick and might not be able to vote. So that brings you down to 50. So, you know, you can see here where the math becomes a problem. And that means you've got to keep all the Republicans in line. So, you know, I'm going to make a prediction here. If Susan Collins and Lisa Murkowski or to both come out and announce that they can't vote for this judge for whatever reason and they're not going to support him, the chances are close to zero that Doug Jones and Joe Manchin and Joe Donnelly from Indiana and Heidi Heitkamp from North Dakota and these other moderate Democrats are going to come rescue him.
Yeah, they don't want to be
the pressure would be too great.
Yeah, they don't want to be the.
They may well vote for him if their vote doesn't matter, but if it does, it's hard to see that they would vote for him, but not the Republicans.
Right, bingo. They don't want to be the confirming vote. You may have, if you did have the Republicans lined up to confirm Kavanaugh, you may get some Democrats that want a little extra push here across the finish line that are up for re-election this year, like a Manchin. They would say, "Oh yeah, yeah, me too," but they're not going to. They're not going to be the person that makes 50.
Right. And if you look at the Republicans, you know, it's a little bit of a different perspective. For Susan Collins and Lisa Murkowski, this is about Roe v. Wade and whether they think that the judge is sufficiently committed to precedent. And, you know, if he were to come out and say that's that's an abomination, like Mobile's own Bill Pryor one time said, you know, that might disqualify them in their eyes. But as long as he sort of does what all the nominees do and say, I take precedent seriously, but I can't say how I'm going to vote, they'll probably get his votes. Now, Rand Paul's concerns are a little different. He's coming at this more of a Fourth Amendment civil libertarian perspective, and he's expressed concerns about Judge Kavanaugh's expansive view of, you know, executive power and the role of the federal government in being able to, spy, essentially, or conduct eavesdrop or... you know, other operations without the Fourth Amendment. Now, you know, my personal view is I'd be shocked if Rand Paul actually votes against him because, you know, all that pressure on these Democratic senators, the pressure is just as great on the Republican senators. And Rand Paul has carefully cultivated a pretty close relationship with President Trump despite some key differences on some things.
That's what I find interesting, though, right? I mean, that's what I pointed out to people.
But for him to come out and vote no... on Kavanaugh, I just have a hard time, you know, believing he would do that. And one, you know, traditionally until the last few years, senators were supposed to evaluate, candidate's fitness for office and their qualifications. And there's no question that Judge Kavanaugh is qualified for this job based on all the criteria that we usually consider. That doesn't mean that this would be Rand Paul's first choice if he were the president, but senators, especially when their own party is concerned, usually defer to the judgment of the president because they are the ones, after all, who won the election. And it'd be hard for Rand Paul, even if he's got some differences of opinion on judicial philosophy, for him to argue that's disqualifying. Now, you know, maybe he surprises me, but that's my own personal view. I actually like an op-ed written by a Yale University law professor who was Kavanaugh's professor when he was in law school. Liberal professor who speaks very highly of Judge Kavanaugh. And his challenge, this is mainly to the liberals in the Senate, if you vote against Judge Kavanaugh, then you ought to be required to name two other possible Supreme Court candidates that a Republican president might reasonably be expected to nominate that you would support. You know, and his view being that if you don't support Kavanaugh, I mean, there's not anyone you're ever going to vote for, and that's not what the system is supposed to do. So that's kind of an interesting challenge. So I mean, you know, every Democratic senator ought to be asked if Judge Kavanaugh is not acceptable, you know, name me two alternatives, you know, that a Republican might reasonably be expected to name, and you know, so not Merrick Garland,
right.
But like someone that a Republican, you know, that you would support, and it'd be just, I doubt you'd get a real answer out of any of them. But you know, if we're just going to make this, you know, the criteria they use to, you know, decide what, you know, level of spending we should have in the Department of Health and Human Services, you know, we're never going to get back to normal in this confirmation process.
There he is, Brendan Kirby. People want to keep this conversation going online. Where do they go?
Yeah, you can go to @BrendanKKirby. Of course, Yellowhammer News or LifeSite.com.
All right, thank you, brother. We'll talk soon.
Thanks a lot.
All right, Paul Feinbaum Show on the way next. I'll see y'all in the morning for Mobile Morning starting at 6. Remember, keep us online, fmtalk1065.com. We'll see you there.